case is United States against Westerfield. Mr. Jones, let's give it a little time for the rustling in the back to die down.
Very well.
I'm assuming that it's not you in particular that's driving large numbers of lawyers out of the room.
I believe you're correct, Your Honor.
Okay, Mr. Jones, give it a try.
Thank you. May it please the Court, Your Honors. My name is Greg Jones, and I represent Lori Westerfield. In March of 2011, Ms. Westerfield was convicted on 3 counts of wire fraud. After reviewing the evidence, or more appropriately, the lack of evidence presented to the District Court, it is clear that this Court should reverse those convictions.
How long had she been a lawyer?
I believe she was admitted to practice in the mid-90s. There are 3 issues before.
And so this and the events here were when?
They were in 2002 and 2003, Your Honor. Now, there are 3 issues.
So she wasn't a neophyte. She had been in practice for a while.
She had been practicing for a number of years, correct, Your Honor. There are 3 issues before the Court today. First, the government failed to present any evidence indicating that Ms. Westerfield had the requisite intent to commit wire fraud. Second, in an attempt to establish that she had that intent, the government presented, and the District Court allowed, improper and prejudicial testimony from a witness that didn't have personal knowledge of the subjects he was testifying on. And third, the District Court improperly calculated the total loss and the restitution amount. Ms. Westerfield was convicted for her role in 3 transactions, yet the total loss and restitution amounts reflect the losses experienced through all 5 transactions. I'd first like to address...
Suggested inadmissible evidence about this is Johnson you're talking about?
Mr. Johnson,
yeah. Yeah. In your dealings with Ms. Westerfield, did you assume that she knew the fraudulent nature of the transactions you had structured? Yes, sir. Now, there's no objection to that.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So why isn't that, you know, something a jury would think, yeah, well, this guy, he ought to know. This is his scheme.
Well,
and you can see the common sense of it. It would be extremely dangerous to have someone at the closing who was not in on the scheme, because that person discovered what was going on and reported you, you'd be finished.
The fact of the matter concerning Mr. Johnson is that he had never witnessed any conversations between Mr. Burnett.
And this was one piece of testimony. And, of course, there was the unusual character of the transactions and the people coming back, buying 3 houses in a month or something, and with these very high loan-to-value ratios. So if you put everything together, don't you have evidence from which a jury could infer that she was in the know?
It's true that there was a sequence of transactions, and it's true that some of the players were the same as well. But in and of itself, that's not indicative that Ms. Westerfield had the requisite intent. loan-to-value ratios are something that mortgage lenders and mortgage brokers are experts in. That is a piece of information that's provided by them. Ms. Westerfield was acting as an attorney at these closings, and based on the record, her involvement consisted of attending the closings and directing the parties where to sign the documents. Moreover, the fact that the same parties participated in multiple transactions in and of itself is not indicative that something is amiss. The record doesn't disclose that the closings were conducted in an improper or strange manner to give Ms. Westerfield notice that something was amiss. The testimony provided rather just indicates that Ms. Westerfield acted as though any other real estate attorney would act at a closing in general. So the evidence presented by the government, while it does establish that Ms. Westerfield did participate in
the
closing.
You have Ross and Robinson. They're each buying three homes in a short period of time. These very high loan-to-value ratios. Doesn't that sound phony?
Well, with specific respect to the loan-to-value ratios, there's nothing in the record indicating that Ms. Westerfield would know what an appropriate loan-to-value ratio is.
Well, I don't understand. Isn't this what she does? This was not her first set of closings.
That's correct. She was
this is what she does.
She was an attorney.
She works for a title insurance company.
That's correct.
Well, she must know something about real estate financing.
But, and she may, but the fact
what
of the matter...
she may? How can she be a lawyer for a title company and not know anything about loan-to-value ratios?
And, Your Honor, I'm not suggesting that she knows nothing about it, but what I am suggesting is the jury made its decision based on the record, and the record does not indicate that Ms. Westerfield had a duty or an obligation to understand the specifics of loan-to-value ratios during the early 2000s when the real estate boom was in high speed and these transactions were occurring on a regular basis. It was much easier to obtain a loan, as we all know, then, as opposed to now, and that in and of itself does not indicate that she has the requisite intent.
Now,
is there any evidence that she was...
The sellers, was it Robinson, the three different sellers?
Correct, Ross and...
But now each of these sellers directs that the profits or the sale revenues be sent to the same entity?
The government...
That's extremely strange, isn't it?
There was a letter of direction, or letters of direction, more accurately, directing the proceeds from these sales to go to specific parties. And the government makes a big deal out of the fact that one of the parties that received the proceeds...
No, look, it's very, very strange. You have three supposedly separate sellers. Why on earth would they each be directing that the money be sent to the same entity? What sense could that have made?
Well,
X sues a home, Y sells a home, Y sells it, Z, and then they say to the buyer, don't give it to me, give it to this other entity.
Correct, and the record reflects that letters of direction, and this is based on testimony provided from the government's witnesses, letters of direction were commonly used.
You're missing my point completely. It's the letter of direction for the proceeds of three sales by three different sellers.
Mm-hmm.
Why are the three different sellers sending the money to the same, fourth party? What could that possibly mean?
Well, a couple things. Similar to the loan-to-value ratio discussion, there's nothing in the record indicating that Ms. Westerfield...
You don't have to be in real estate to ask... For what possible reason could three separate sellers of private residence direct that the money be received not by them but by some third party, even though the three sellers are not connected with each other?
Well, Ms. Westerfield, again, Your Honor, is acting as the real estate attorney. She was.
I'm asking you.
Me personally?
Yeah.
Well, I admittedly do not practice a lot in residential real estate.
Well, you tell me what's possible non-fraudulent inference can be drawn from those letters of direction.
Well, just based on personal experience and understanding what the market was in 2002.
Just a matter of common sense. Why are three different sellers, each of a private house, directing that the proceeds be sent to some entity.
Well, in the case of the Brandy Amos transactions, where she purchased three separate houses, she was a stand-in seller, or stand-in
buyer. I'm talking
buyer.
About the sellers. The sellers get the money.
Correct.
They issue the letters of direction.
Yes, that's correct.
And instead of their getting the money themselves, they send it to some other party. Now, tell me what non-fraudulent explanation could be given for that.
Well, in this case, you had admittedly a certain cast of characters that did repeat itself. You had, in the Megan Ross transactions, you had the same...
You're not answering my question.
Well, I'm sorry, Your Honor. What I'm trying to get to is that the fact that the letters of direction directed the proceeds to one entity for different sales, when you were dealing with a same cast of characters in different transactions, in and of itself would not
what
necessarily...
What do you mean same cast of characters? The sellers are different.
Correct, but the purchasers are the same.
But the purchasers don't issue the letter of direction. The purchasers are giving the money to the sellers, and for some strange reason... These ostensibly separate sellers are sending the money to the same different party.
I would agree. I do not understand how Ms. Westerfield would have an obligation, and the record doesn't reflect how she would have an obligation, to investigate the party to which that letters of direction are steering the funds. She attended the closings as an attorney that directed parties where to sign, and made sure that the closings went off in an appropriate manner.
Who is her client? Who does she represent?
She represented Attorneys Title Guarantee Fund as the closing agent, and then she also, it was a bit of a hybrid situation where she also helped the parties in the transaction complete the documents.
Title Guarantee, I assume that's title insurance of some kind?
Correct, Your Honor.
Yeah, and title insurance usually discloses if there are any liens on the property.
That's
if,
right.
Somebody else holds a mortgage, it has to be paid off, obviously, at the closing and all that sort of thing. I assume that's what she does, it must be all those normal ones, I was going to ask if there any evidence that she does this for people other than this type of folks.
She'd been retained by Attorney Title Guarantee Fund for more than a year.
Okay, so she will soon does a lot of legitimate closings.
Correct.
And almost every one of them. It's an existing home. There's going to be perhaps an existing mortgage that has to be paid off. They will have to check for other liens. And obviously, there weren't any here.
Correct. She and Ms. Westerfield's role as the attorney, she ordered the title commitment, which was prepared by parties based on information from third parties, which was then reviewed by the buyers and the sellers.
So what do? Is it part of the scheme where they do a letter search on these houses and make sure that all their they don't have any mortgages?
Correct.
So they can get away with not having to show
There'd be no outstanding
lien. So they get a lien-free house or find one and then pretend that these are the owners and then they sell that house and then send the money to somebody other than... The owners, obviously.
That's correct, Your Honor. There would be no liens on those properties.
Okay, and that didn't arouse any suspicion from her, huh?
Well, I think in the record it indicates that she operated as an attorney at these closings, and I would assume that as an attorney operating at a closing, if the title report didn't show any liens...
But that's who she represents. It's her client.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay.
I'd also like to discuss the improper testimony that was admitted by the district court. And we touched on this a little bit earlier. But specifically, the government argues that the testimony from Freddie Johnson should have been admitted as in order to explain Ms. Westerfield's role in the scheme. And specifically, the government elicited testimony concerning Ms. Westerfield's compensation, her knowledge, and her involvement. The government's explanation is somewhat nonsensical. If the standard were that the jury only that evidence would be permitted just to explain to the jury Ms. Westerfield's role in the transaction, then it's hard to imagine a situation when anyone would not be allowed to testify regardless of whether or not they had personal knowledge. Now, in Mr. Johnson's case, he testified that he assumed that Mr. Burnett was paying Ms. Westerfield for her role in the transactions. Mr. Johnson did not witness any conversations between Ms. Westerfield and Mr. Burnett, nor did he have any other knowledge, personal or otherwise, that such compensation arrangement was in place. Moreover, Mr. Johnson also testified that he assumed that Mr. Burnett had informed Ms. Westerfield.
Well, did her lawyer tell the jury then?
I'm sorry, I didn't catch the
first
part.
Did her lawyer tell the jury then?
No, Your Honor.
What you just said.
No, Your Honor. The attorney for Mr. Westerfield, or Ms. Westerfield, rather, rested on the government's case. But getting back to the point, Mr. Johnson did not witness any conversations between Mr. Burnett and Ms. Westerfield concerning the fraudulent scheme at all. And this evidence was admitted. And to the heart of the issue, this is prejudicial. It's unclear that the jury did not consider this information while voting to convict Ms. Westerfield. The government argues otherwise. They assert that the jury didn't consider it. And it's unclear based on the record or any other information how that argument holds up. However, what is known is that you cannot say beyond a reasonable doubt that Ms. Westerfield, that the jury did not consider this information.
What about his testimony? He says, so he's asked, would you have expected LaAndre Burnett to recruit an attorney unaware of the transaction's fraudulent nature? He says, no, sir. Why do you say that? And so on. You have to have somebody to trust, because if you didn't trust them, they could find out what's going on. Is there anything wrong with that testimony?
Well, it's speculative, and it's indicating what he believes.
Well,
LaAndre
Burnett. He's in the business, right? He knows all about this fraud stuff. He does it. And he says you have to have somebody to trust. Now, isn't he speaking from his personal knowledge?
I think the issue with that testimony is that the question was phrased to ask whether LaAndre Burnett would have brought someone in that he didn't trust. And that is prejudicial in and of itself. And it appears that I'm out of time.
Well, when he says you have to have somebody to trust, is that inadmissible?
If he's speaking from his own vantage point, I don't believe that's inadmissible. But he's brought LaAndre Burnett into that answer and that question. The way it's phrased indicates that LaAndre Burnett brought Ms. Westerfield into the scheme. It appears that I'm out of time, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, counsel. Mr. Harriman.
Good morning. My name is Joel Hammerman. I represent the United States. If it may please the court. Your Honors, there was compelling circumstantial evidence to support the jury's verdict in this case. Lori Westerfield was an experienced attorney representing both buyers and sellers in real estate transactions for years. She was brought to this scheme by LaAndre Burnett, who recruited her to act on behalf of the scheme in preparing these real estate transactions. She began working in furtherance of the scheme and on these transactions weeks before the actual closings at which the sales transpired occurred. She prepared title commitments, where she prepared the sale of property and, in a sense, assisted for the future sale of property of three homes from three different sellers, financed by three different lenders, in 3 weeks. In the case of the Megan Ross transactions and in the case of the Eddie Robinson transactions, she prepared documents that would facilitate the sale of two homes financed by two different lenders in 2 weeks. She then appeared at the closings, not only representing the title company, but also representing the sellers. She was paid to act as the seller's counsel at those transactions. But she had never met her alleged clients before. She had no relationship with those alleged clients because those clients didn't exist. There were no sellers. There were only individuals there pretending to be sellers.
Who represented the lenders?
The lenders?
Yeah.
At a closing, the closer has a fiduciary obligation to the lenders. The closer is an independent contractor that was retained by the title company. Their job is to ensure that in fact, all the documents are executed, in particular the documents transferring title to execute the sale and documents securing the mortgage for the financing that's provided for those properties, Your Honor.
Was that Westerfield or somebody else?
No, the closers were three different individuals, all of whom testified at the trial. It was Joni, Sierra, Christine Peterson, and Melinda Josephs.
Were they present with Westerfield? Was there?
They all testified that they spent most of the time during these transactions actually out of the room. A closer, and they testified to this effect, all three witnesses, has the responsibility to make sure the documents are signed appropriately, and they have to check them in the end. Often, when there are no attorneys, a closer will sit in and ensure that the documents are executed appropriately. But when there is an attorney present, the attorney often fills that role. And so by bringing in an attorney like Lori Westerfield, the closers weren't present and didn't see how these documents were being executed by the various parties. And in that sense, Lori Westerfield acted as a buffer between these individuals who were not involved in the transactions.
You're saying that the closer, who's supposed to, represents the lender, where the money's coming from, depended on the fact that the other lawyer was in there, that they didn't have an obligation to scrutinize whether or not this was where all this money is going, a lot of money is going. There are no liens on the property or the ownership or anything.
The obligation of the closers to make sure that there is going to be a lien placed on the property for the mortgage that's being provided by the lender. They have to make sure the documents are executed appropriately. With respect to the proceeds that are being generated from the sale, the closers also act as escrow agents. They make sure that the requisite funds are brought to the transaction and that they're appropriately distributed. All three of these closers and the individual who was the general counsel for the title company, Attorney Titles Guarantee Fund, testified that in order for proceeds from a sale not to be provided to the sellers, there had to be instruction from the attorney who is representing the sellers, in this case, Ms. Westerfield. And so they would not cut checks to a party other than the sellers unless they were instructed by the attorney for the seller. So Ms. Westerfield facilitated the sale of all these properties and then facilitated that the proceeds were generated or provided to this non-existent third party again and again and again. And the closers only were allowed to do that because she authorized that. She, in fact, drafted the letters of direction and then authorized that the funds be provided to this non-existent third party.
So each of the closers testified that they relied upon her then?
Yes. The closers said that they were that they would not send the proceeds to a third party without the authorization of the seller's attorney. And in all of these transactions, the seller's attorney was Lori Westerfield. So the answer to that, and that's for the first three transactions, Your Honor, that's for the Megan Ross transactions. The closer from the Eddie Robinson transactions did not testify at the trial. But for those first three, they made it clear what the policy was of ATGF, the title company, and that they had relied on Ms. Westerfield and her instruction that the proceeds from the sale were to be provided to this third party. And there was five transactions here. All of the proceeds from the first transaction were provided to a corporate entity that actually was a shell corporation that was controlled by the architect of this scheme, Freddie Johnson. The next four transactions, all of the proceeds were provided to an individual by the name of Richard Preston, who is a non-existent individual. He had passed away in the 1960s. There was an individual, his brother, that was using a fake, had assumed his identity and was using fake identification to cash the checks generated from these transactions.
And Westerfield was supervising those as well or not?
All five of these transactions. She was the lawyer that prepared requisite sale documents and then oversaw the closings, instructing parties where to sign.
Now, there's some objection that the other two were used as relevant conduct in coming up with the total loss.
That's, I think, an incorrect characterization by defense counsel, Your Honor. Ms. Westerfield was convicted of a scheme to defraud. She was charged in the execution of four counts of that scheme to defraud. But all five of these transactions were alleged in the scheme, and all five of these transactions were proved at trial as part of the scheme. So there was evidence that she was perpetrating and assisting this scheme to defraud. And so all the five transactions for which she was held responsible in both amounts of loss and restitution were the transactions she helped facilitate. She was, in the end, only convicted of three counts of executing that scheme, but she was charged with and convicted of facilitating a larger scheme.
So you're saying that the judge could use relevant conduct as proof of just preponderance of the evidence and determine that?
I would suggest, Your Honor, that it's not actually relevant conduct, that it's part of the counts of conviction. In the fact that there was only three executions of the scheme does not mean that she was only convicted of three individual criminal acts. She was convicted of a scheme. That scheme encompassed five transactions. The first transaction, for example, the June 10th 2003 sale of property from Ruth Williams to Megan Ross, who, of course, weren't actually buying nor selling property. That was not actually charged as an execution count in the scheme, but it was alleged as part of the scheme. And so because she helped facilitate that sale, the losses that were incurred by the lender as a result of that fraudulent transaction are properly, she's held, properly held accountable for those losses. And that's what Judge Deryagian found. He found that she was a member of the scheme, that she had helped facilitate the scheme, and that all five of these transactions were part of that scheme. In addition, in her sentencing arguments, Ms. Westerfield acknowledged that she, in fact, was responsible for all five of those transactions and did not contest those loss amounts, not only by not objecting to the total loss amount in the PSR, but in trying to argue that she shouldn't be held accountable for more victims, she affirmatively stated and acknowledged that she was responsible for all five transactions. She noted and characterized in her objections to the pre-sentence investigation report that there were four victim lenders, and there were four lenders for these five transactions. There were three counts of conviction with three lenders. So by acknowledging that there was an additional lender, she explicitly accepted the fact that all five of these transactions were properly characterized as losses attributable to her conduct. And so the argument that's being presented by defense counsel to your honor.
Well, there's a difference between saying I was involved in five transactions and I committed fraud five times.
Yes, but in her objections to the pre-sentence report, your honor, she states that these four lenders incurred pecuniary losses attributable to her conduct. So it's not that she's just acknowledging that she was involved in five transactions and that the five transactions resulted in losses. She's actually acknowledging that those losses are properly attributable to her. And she did that because one of the arguments that she made was only victims who have losses attributable to them count as victims when calculating the number of victims for the enhancement under the guidelines. And she took the position that, yes, the lenders to all of these transactions are properly characterized as victims. However, other individuals, in particular, the identity theft victims associated with this scheme, are not properly accounted in calculating the number of victims for her sentencing. That was the argument she made. And so she accepted the fact that all of these victims were lenders and, in effect, waived the argument that she is now presenting to your honors on appeal.
As I recall, Judge Deryagian said something about a larger scheme that Johnson was involved in, and there were other sentences. Is that correct? Because he was talking about some consistency in the sentence.
There was a larger scheme. There was 12 defendants charged in this case. The scheme that's alleged in the indictment covered 17 different properties, and at trial there was evidence that other scheme participants, in particular, Brandy Amos, had participated in three additional transactions where she had once again fraudulently represented herself to be someone who she was not, that the other, and Willie Collins, who testified at trial, and Marilyn Rainey, similarly acknowledged that they had partaken in other transactions. And Mr. Johnson did the same when he testified. So there was evidence of a larger scheme. Ms. Westerfield was not implicated in those other transactions, the ones that she did not participate in, and was not held responsible for them at sentencing by Judge Deryagian.
Well, I was only looking at the sort of implied, maybe I just missed it, is that it was consistent with the other type of other sentencing. Maybe I'm wrong on that.
There was, I think Judge Deryagian was referring to some of the other arguments other than the question of loss that had been raised in other sentencings for other defendants in the case. Other defendants had been already sentenced, and arguments concerning the number of victims had already been raised, and I think that's what he was referring to when he made that comment at sentencing. But with respect to loss, this wasn't something that was contested at sentencing. It was acknowledged by Ms. Westerfield. I want to briefly, if I may, address the issue defense counsel raises with respect to the questions that were asked of Mr. Johnson regarding his understanding of the relationship between Lori Westerfield and Leandre Burnett and the transactions at large. I think, Judge Posner, your questions are right. This is a question of trust. And that was the questions that are focused on by defense counsel are, in a sense, taken out of context. If you read the entirety of the examination of Mr. Johnson at that time, the point that is brought out through that line of questioning is, would you bring someone to these transactions, five different transactions, in which sellers are having the entire value of their property sent to some non-existent entity that's not at the closing? Would you bring that lawyer to this transaction when she ostensibly is there to represent those sellers? Would you bring the same lawyer to represent or oversee a transaction in which a buyer is purchasing three houses in 3 weeks, financed by three different lenders, at these very high loan-to-value ratios? Would you do that? And his point is, no, you couldn't do that. You had to have someone you could trust. And that testimony was incredibly relevant for that purpose. And that's what was argued to the jury by both the government at closing. It was argued by the government at closing. And with respect to your question of did defense counsel address that issue, he did. He cross-examined Mr. Johnson on it, and he argued about it at closing. He said that assumptions can't be made. They're just nothing but assumptions. So it was addressed by counsel. Nevertheless, it was argued that this was all issues that were brought up as a matter of trust. Defense counsel also said in his remarks that letters of direction, these letters that Ms. Westerfield authored that provided for the proceeds of these sales to be sent to these third parties, were not uncommon. The testimony at trial was quite the opposite. Of the three closers that testified, Melinda Josephs said that although she had been a closer for many of years and had overseen countless numbers of transactions, that she had never seen a transaction in which all of the seller's proceeds were provided to some third party. And this is, of course, a unique set of circumstances where there are no liens existing against the properties at the time of sale. The entire value of these properties were lien-free sales of homes, and all of that money was going somewhere else. Melinda Joseph said she had never seen that. Another closer, Joni Sierra, said that it was not very often and that she had overseen thousands of transactions. Not very often that she had seen all of the proceeds from the seller go to a third party. The third closer, Christine Peterson, said it was extremely rare to see all of the proceeds from a sale of a home go to a third party. That was happening again and again and again. Five times it happened. And for four of those instances, all of the money went to the same party. So it was extremely rare, is the answer to your question. And it wasn't common, as suggested by defense counsel.
And they all say, I guess, that they counted on her?
They all relied on her, yes, Your Honor.
Yeah.
She was the lawyer, and she had to, in a sense, author the letter of direction, and she had to approve of the funds being provided to this third party. And these closers weren't present for three Megan Ross transactions. It was Lori Westerfield who was. They were there for one transaction at a time, and they relied on her. It was a rare request, but it was a request made by an attorney, and they were, in a sense, following the policies that were required by her employer. I see that my time is up. If there are no further questions. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. We appreciate your willingness to take the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.